I always say the design process is messy and kind of non-linear. So if all your other processes around that can be very rigid, then I think you're sort of set up for success.
Hi, I'm Caitlin Peterson, the editor-in-chief of Business at Home. Welcome to Trade Tales, where I'll be talking to interior designers about the challenges, pivots, and perspective shifts that come with growing a design firm. My hope is that you hear your own why echoed in these stories, or an idea that sparks your own breakthrough. I hope it helps you realize that even when entrepreneurship feels lonely, you're not alone. My guest today is a designer whose boundless creative energy led him to a career in architecture, and then fashion, and ultimately, interiors. Now, he's intent on pushing the limits of his craft with new challenges, like designing in the metaverse, and some special side projects that have no client attached to them. Along the way, he's establishing airtight systems to guide his firm's output, even as his inspiration runs wild. I can't wait to share it with you. But first, a quick word from our sponsors. This podcast is sponsored by Regina Andrew, a luxury lifestyle brand specializing in lighting, furniture, and decor. Born in the Paris of the Midwest, the brand's roots run deep in the city it calls home. The style and character of Detroit have shaped who they are, what they make, and how they make it. With a deep commitment to soulfully crafting heirloom quality items, Regina Andrew's pursuit of inspiration has taken its team across the world to discover materials and forms that drive its designs. Crafted with passionate attention to detail and a quest to deliver the unexpected, Regina Andrew's products, much like the journey that inspired them, each have a story. Save 10% off your next purchase now through November 15th by using the code BOH10 at reginaandrew.com. This podcast is also sponsored by The Shade Store. The Shade Store offers designers everywhere a simplified resource for handcrafted custom window treatments. With a team of dedicated design consultants available to guide you through the material and product selection process, a vast network of measure and install professionals to ensure the perfect fit, and more than 150 showrooms nationwide, The Shade Store offers the bespoke customization of a high-end workroom, backed by the support of a national organization. Let The Shade Store take care of the window treatments for you by signing up for a trade account today at theshadestore.com/trade.
When I was in sixth grade, our teacher gave us this assignment to draw a plan of your house. And for some reason, I took that assignment very seriously. I would go to the magazine store or whatever at that point was the supermarket and buy the real estate magazines, which then at the end had a little card and you would bubble in the houses that you were interested in. So I would send them back. And, you know, these real estate agents probably got this back and thought, oh my gosh, this buyer from Miami is interested in all these properties worldwide. And they would send me the marketing materials for all of these properties that were multi-million dollars. And so I would sit there and study the floor plans with the pictures and try to correlate those two. And it kind of awoke in me this idea that you could depict spaces in this two-dimensional floor plan.
That's Luis Fernandez. After poring over all those real estate listings, he went on to earn his degree in architecture and then kicked off his career working for several big firms in New York. He quickly learned that the job wasn't quite as exciting as he had hoped. And at the same time, a fashion business that he had started as a hobby soon turned into a full-fledged career pivot that would keep him busy for more than a decade.
I started this little t-shirt brand, a little side hustle with a friend. We got picked up by a showroom. Overnight, we went into 20 stores, mostly Japan. It snowballed into a full-on menswear brand we were showing in Fashion Week. I got into the CFDA. That took 15 years of my career. I got to practice architecture when it came to designing our stores or designing the choreography and the spaces for our Fashion Week shows, which was another way of flexing that creative spirit.
After growing disenchanted with the fashion industry, Luis was ready for a new creative challenge. A move to the West Coast gave him the fresh start he was looking for.
8 years ago, kind of exactly to the day we moved to LA, it was at a time when I knew I didn't want to continue fashion. And in some ways, the world of interior design and architecture seemed a lot more exciting and a lot more future forward than fashion did at the time. And so I did a house restoration of a mid-century modern house here in LA. And it was the first time that I was able to apply all the facets of the job, right? Architecture, interior design, landscape into one project. And that project very fortunately got published and got the cover of Elle Decor in October of 2021. And it kind of just propelled me right back into architecture and interior design. And here we are now.
After the Elle Decor feature in 2021, Luis officially established his firm. I wanted to talk to him about how he's carefully considering how much liability he wants to take on with each new job, what he's learning while exploring different approaches to billing, and why he's appreciated this phase of working on his own rather than staffing up. What happened next? You know, you get this article comes out, people you don't know start calling. How did you start to make sense of those calls and of how you wanted to approach designing, especially for strangers?
You know, I think you sort of adapt quite quickly. And then I think I didn't overthink it. Obviously, you know, that writing that first contract was hard. and talk about something that completely continues to evolve. And from every project, you learn how to like reframe the contract for the next project that you write. So it's been a learning lesson. And sure, have there been a couple projects where you should have set it up differently from the beginning, but you sort of just to suck up the punches and keep moving, right? And hope that in the end, you're creating a great project and that'll, you know, kind of, again, launch the next one. And you know, just making sure that the clients in the end are happy. And so I've also been fortunate in that regard that have both become friends with the clients as a result of the process, and they're happy. And they send me notes, which is, talk about like one of the biggest highlights of this profession, right? Like when a client sends you a note and says, I'm sitting here and I really am enjoying this space so much, I just needed to send you a note. Like that right there, there's no price in the world that can beat that. So yeah, that part has also been really nice. And now, you know, once you start to learn the lessons and you get some inquiry calls, there are certain red flags that immediately you're like, nope, not for me. And it's not so much like not a project for me, but sometimes maybe like not a client for me.
I love that difference in, you know, the personal versus the, I don't want to characterize your early work as impersonal, but Dulles Airport and Barney's stores have less feelings, right, than an individual homeowner. And there's certainly maybe less voices in the room. How did you have to adapt early on from, you know, I'm one of 30 people on this project to, all right, it's me and the homeowner. Like, what did that require?
That's a really good question. And it's funny because I've never fully thought about that. I mean, there's certainly a difference when you're working for a property management EP who does this all the time. Although the Barney's, that was quite special. Because those stores had so much soul and story, but it is very different to have residential clients and especially if it's the type that this is their hard-earned savings and they finally get to design this house or restore this house or renovate this house. And that's very different. And obviously it comes with a lot of challenges. Right. Because it is more emotional and you do get the calls. I literally just got an email from new clients a couple minutes ago with an inspiration picture that they found. So it becomes a very emotional, and you know, you get those texts that 6 a.m. on a Saturday.
Right. I was just thinking, yeah.
Exactly. And I think what I keep reminding myself is that your job ends up becoming more of, or my job ends up becoming more of like a coordinator or a like a symphony director, where I'm hearing you, I see what you're thinking, but I need to make sure that it fits into the full part of the project, proportions, scale, you know, like everything has to be addressed, because it's very easy. And this is one of the things I've noticed is becoming slightly problematic. There are so many of those AI rendering images out there that clients keep sending me. And it's like, okay, but that's not a real space. And I love, I'm all for it. I love the inspiration aspect of that. But if a chair isn't depicted in the dimensions and the clearance that you need around that chair to make that space work, then that image sort of fails as that inspiration, right? Like you can't achieve that and still step into it. And so I think that that's becoming like the new client education, where it's like, okay, I love that image, but let me tell you why we can't do that. I mean, talk about an industry when you go into residential design where you're a therapist, you're a counselor.
Were you prepared for that?
Not as much as I definitely was not prepared for it. But you kind of, I mean, I guess I do have the natural disposition for that. And sometimes I would even think I'm a sucker for that, right? Like I get myself into situations and I'm a pleaser. So I try to like make it all better all the time. And sometimes you're like, oh my gosh. I've only like ended up firing one client because it just got too much to be too much.
Like the things they were asking for, or like what they asked of you?
It was more what they asked of me.
Can I ask, like, what's the line for you? Like where, or what kind of boundaries have you tried to put in place so that that continues to feel productive or positive, the emotional connection with the client?
I think, I mean, in that particular case, they basically just wanted someone to be around all day long as entertainment, companion. And it very much was a type of household, which was like entourage driven. There were people around all the time and it was all about the circus for entertainment all day long. And at some point you're like, I'm a professional. I'm not, you know, I'm not a, like I can't be here all day long to like have multiple discussions about a lampshade for 4 days. I understand that like you really want that entertainment value of that, but that's not what I can do. And so, so I had to bow out of that situation.
What makes you say yes to a job now?
I think the client's energy. I think that's super key. And then I think it's the projects when they're like, okay, we have no budget. We don't really want to pay a design fee and we want to put the moon in our house. That's where you're like, hard no, absolutely not. Right.
Right.
And then I've said yes to a couple of those along the way and not in a, you know, not big projects, but, and then they turn around and they flip the house for 10 times. And so you start to realize that you were kind of a cog in the wheel of a flip project with no gains. And I think that for like, especially in a place like LA, New York also, I think I'm becoming more cognizant of that, right? Like your designer is not is not someone who is part of your money-making scheme. The minute that someone doesn't value the industry and not want to pay a design fee, I think that's a very telling part right there.
How have you structured the financial piece of the firm, the billing piece of the firm? And what informed your approach?
I love that you asked that question like I have a full grasp of it. Because I'm still trying to figure that part out. It's all still pretty grassroots, to be honest. It's the email every month that I hate sending to clients, right? Because again, there's a lot of self-doubt in that process, right? Are they going to receive this bill and be like, oh my God, what, you know, why? Or are they going to receive this bill and be like, yes, you're not charging us enough, which is never the case. But yeah, it's all very grassroots still. And that's the area where like my business has sort of doubled over the last 2 years every year. And so now it's getting to the point where it is becoming, I do need some structure and I do need a system around that.
Well, what do you have in place now or how does it work now?
I mean, I have an account management firm that helps me with all the big stuff, but on a daily invoicing, that's still all just me. So like I don't do the purchasing myself. It always goes right to the client. And a lot of my friends are like, oh my gosh, like you could be, or my industry friends are like, you could be like overcharging on that, or you could be making profit on that. I figured out a way to do profit in a different way so that I'm not creating a crazy bookkeeping also job for myself.
Can you tell me more about that? How are you charging then?
And I'm still exploring different versions of how to bill. So one of the latest ones that I'm testing right now is pricing per square foot. Mm-hmm. And you can get a sense of the type of scope, right? Is this a room that is going to be super tricked out and every millwork detail has to be, you know, drawn out in plan, section, elevation? Or is this a more simplistic project, right? And so I think you can get a sense of that. And so I've been testing out this pricing per square foot on the recommendation of other industry friends as well. I've tried the hourly, which is hard hourly, right? Because a client never fully understands how much time goes into something. And then there's also, how do you bill the non-tangible? If you're out shopping on a Saturday and you're discovering things as opposed to being sitting on a beach, how do you bill that time? You kind of don't. And so you leave somewhat on the table by billing hourly, I think. And then I try to avoid the flat fee. I always do a flat fee with either with a cap or an understanding of what led to the generation of that flat fee. But, you know, in all the instances that I would go over. The other one's the price per budget. That's becoming harder, and it's definitely a discussion amongst my peers where if you price per budget, especially in today's world where we actually don't really know what things cost because of these tariffs, the price of labor that's disappearing, it's becoming really hard to price per budget. I also feel there's this perception from the client where they think you're always driving for more expensive things. For
by price per budget, do you mean just like a percentage of the budget?
Yes. And that, I mean, historically, that's been a pretty robust way of billing for a long time. But that one's getting harder and harder because the cost of things is very kind of a roller coaster right now. But also that perception. And if you know, when you talk to clients and they tell you their stories of working with the designer and working with an architect, they always feel that if that's the case, they're being kind of steered to something more expensive because they get a bigger profit. And so I think to not bill that way, I'm loving it because you could steer to get the better, nicer dining table, which is more expensive, but the client doesn't feel like I'm driving that because I'm making money off of that.
We're taking a quick break to remind designers about one of the benefits of the Shade Store's trade program. Trade exclusive access to the Shade Store COM program for Roman shades, drapery, and cornices. Combined with the Shade Store's extensive collection of more than 1,200 in-stock materials, the creative possibilities are virtually endless. Visit theshadestore.com/trade and sign up for a trade account today to learn more. When you are pricing per square foot now, That fee that the client pays represents all of the work that your firm will do for them. And then how often are you billing that? Like, is that just one big check? Is that spaced out throughout the course of a project? Or how does the money come in?
Right now, I have it set up so that there's a fairly hefty percentage that is a retainer and is non-refundable. If you change your mind, then I think I learned my lesson along the way where you do a lot of the heavy lifting and a lot of the emotional commitment to a project in that first month or two. And then the client would then 3 months in say, you know what, we decided we're not going to do this, or we're going to sell the house and do something else. And so, and it's like, well, I've already kind of like fully vested myself into this.
What percentage are you charging at the start?
I would say it's almost like 20% of the total fee upfront. And then the remainder gets divvied up per phase. So at the completion of phase one is a percentage. At the completion of the conceptual phase, another percentage. And then with a small minor percentage at the end on completion and punch list. And that also, if you are having to kind of supercharge the team to deliver five phases in 1 month and you have to ramp up your costs, then you get compensated for that in the 5 months. If that drags out over a course of several months, then the billing drags out as well. I had a conversation with a friend who is interviewing architects, and she was asking me, and I've seen this in several contracts where there's a time, kind of like a time expire on a fee.
So like if we don't finish this within X number of months, like you have to pay to restart basically?
Or pay more, like it becomes more expensive if this project lingers, which is kind of an interesting thought. And I'm trying to figure out how to structure that. Because like some of these projects can linger for none of your own doing. A lot of it is actually contractor generated. That's another thing where I'm trying to be cognizant of, especially right now when getting contractors, labor is becoming like, again, more difficult than it's been. A lot of that for like ICE and all of that that's happening. But so many times, like you can have so much more work if the client decides to go with the cheap contractor. And I know that that's like not earth-shattering news, but I'm realizing that where there are instances where I should have pushed my foot down and said, no, we can't hire that contractor. One, because you're going to regret it. But two, it makes a lot more work for me. And then there's the factor of like the babysitting time and how do you bill babysitting hours?
I want you to call it that on your invoice. Like I babysat your contractor for 14 hours this week.
Yes. Actually, that's a great idea.
See how that goes over and let me know.
Yeah. I mean, it also kind of illustrates the fact that, and it's that saying, right? Like you get what you pay for. But then, like, if you decide to save on the contractor and make your life miserable at the same time, then, like, I'm going to have to bill more.
Do you currently bill for the project management component?
I had, up until recently, I had included it. And it becomes exhausting. It can be super easy. And with the right contractor, it can be a walk. Or it could be really, really tough. And so now I've started to adjust my contract where there's a certain amount of hours of that construction. But then beyond that, then it becomes hourly. And I think that helps with that whole lingering.
That might help people choose the better contractor too.
Yes. And it's important. I've never understood the designers that are not involved in the construction process. I mean, if I could, I would love to be there all day long, but that's obviously not sustainable. But the success of how something gets built and finished depends so much on you being there. I've never been part of a project where you can kind of just phone it in and
it's beautiful at the end.
Yeah. And you arrive 3 years later and you're like, oh my God, this is exactly what I drew. It just doesn't, it never happens that way.
I want to ask you one more money question, because you mentioned a few minutes ago that you're really just funneling purchasing right to your clients. Can you tell me what that means? Because I think a lot of people listening to this will find that revelatory and maybe find the purchasing process to be one of the most painful.
Yeah, I think, I mean, the parts that scare me there, I think with all of this, the bigger piece for me that's always a driver is, what is the cost of liability?
That's a great question.
I think when you are doing the purchasing and then just giving a bill to your client 2x or 0.25x or whatever, you now are buying that liability for yourself. And it's happening more and more where the quality control globally is kind of gone down the drain. And so that table arrives and it's the wrong thing from what was ordered. It's broken. You now have to address all of that. And so I think it's more liability. And so if you can, and bookkeeping. And so if you can just have that go back to the vendor, then that's kind of off your list of liabilities. I mean, I'm still building the order with the vendor, but then the actual execution of that order is done through the client.
Mm-hmm.
So, because otherwise I would be buying it, I'd be taking it in, I then make that item appear on installation day for the client. There's just a lot more situations where that can go wrong.
Are you having stuff then sent directly to the client's home, like on a rolling basis, or are you still warehousing and then installing everything?
Mostly, I mean, it depends on the stage of the project or the type, but yeah, going to and I highly always suggest this, going to a fulfillment, like receiving place, who then does the inspection upon arrival is priceless. I was on a project where, and this was a large house, I would say 75% of the items arrived damaged, broken.
God.
And this was, you know, a mix of high, low, and more high than low. But yeah, it was crazy. And I, at some point, I kind of was like, is our tolerance level really low? Because this can't be. But no, I mean, I do think there's something happening in the world right now where quality control is not at the highest that we've seen.
How do experiences like that inform where you want to shop? Or how you source in general?
That's a really good question. I mean, it definitely has altered going back to the same vendor. And it's more of a loyalty thing. If I have three instances with one vendor, I'm not going to go back there again. It's also about how they address it and fix it and make it better, which it's wild to see how differently that's addressed, right? Like certain people are like, oh my God, we're so sorry. We're going to do all of this to fix it and make it better and make the client happy. Other people, you almost have to like argue with them to get it fixed.
Do clients see that process? Are you shielding them from that back and forth around damages, or are they sort of involved and updated in what's happening every step of the way?
You know, for some reason, a lot of my clients so far want to be involved in the process down to the nitty gritty. And half the time I'm like, but why? don't you just want to like arrive on installation day and everything's already set? And I think that's another of those learning lessons of kind of trying to encourage the clients
to tune out a little bit.
Exactly. Exactly. I actually asked the client recently because he created a joint thread for the two clients, myself, the like their PA and the contractor. And so every single question from the contractor on that text, they were exposed to. And some of it is normal day-to-day questions. But to a client, some of them felt like they were alarming and everything's wrong with the project. And so at some point I was like, do you really want to be on this text thread? Like, doesn't it drive you crazy that it's pinging all day long with random questions going back and forth? And so, and they said, no, we still want to be on it. So I think moving forward, I'm going to try to not have that.
Does that create like kind of side problems for you to kind of like calm them down then? Or have they been pretty mellow
about
it?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, yeah. Fairly mellow, but yeah, there were certain cases, there were certain times where it was like, you know, that I would have been alarmed if I was the client as well. But yeah, and also, I mean, that also has opened up this whole conversation of how do you communicate with clients and with the contractor? And that was a project where the contractor insisted on texting. And I feel like text, for the purposes of administration of business and certainly construction, is you can't search it, you can't archive it. And so, I mean, literally things would get caught in the text. And so they weren't actionable. And I think, so as much as possible, it was like, can we take this back to email where you can file, archive, save, do from your computer, put attachments, add. And so that whole communication with clients, because we now have so many vehicles for communication, is becoming problematic, right? Because I have certain clients where there's text thread, multiple text threads, depending on who's on it, email, and then DMs on Instagram, if they're sending you something that they like, or they comment on something you post. And so that's yet another kind of vehicle for like maintaining communication. And there was, and then the WhatsApp as well. And so kind of streamlining that conversation so that everything can get documented and recorded and filed is actually becoming somewhat of an issue. And the more that you steer people to email, I get it. It's so much easier to send a quick text.
Right.
But it doesn't help the process.
How are you talking to clients about money, about what their budget represents, and about kind of how far their budget can take them?
It's tough, right? No one sets out, I mean, I know we joke about it all the time, like the, and there is no budget, meaning like it's endless. That doesn't really exist. The wealthiest clients are in the end the most frugal, really. And the more you can have that honest conversation, and even in some cases, education with your clients, I think there's always that misconception that expensive means precious means high design.
Mm.
And so it's not necessarily that it's going to be precious, but it's the opposite, right? That it's well made and lasting. And then there's the conversation too of, where is the balance, right? Like, where can you, and I love that part of the conversation, right? Not everything has to be $1 million. The mix of high, low, the mix of different price ranges is actually what makes a project successful. But also where do you want to flex and where do you want to like be more frugal? And every client has a completely different,
right,
realm of what, where they see the flex. I had a client who did not care whatsoever about, you know, the plumbing fixtures, so the faucets, and which to me is like a big one.
A big place to invest, you mean? Or
exactly, yes.
Yeah, okay.
Like you touch that every day, like the you know, plastic versus actual metal makes a big difference. He yet loved marble. And we ended up doing marble slab flooring in the master bedroom. And as much as I tried to say, like, that is the worst place to put that money because half of it is going to be covered by a rug and the other half by a bed. that was a place where they really, really wanted that. And so, you know, at some point it's like, I like to give the clients what they wanted.
Right. Yeah.
I illustrated why I thought that was not a great use of money, but that they wanted it. But I think it's that conversation of like balance at the end of the day and trying to understand why they have that value system. Similar anecdote, I have clients who absolutely do not want anything vintage. And I think it's a cultural thing. And this idea of living with other people's stuff. And then also this idea of like, you've succeeded, you've thrived in life, you should be able to afford new things, not old things that have been used. And it was just, it took me a while to understand that. But once I did, it made sense for that client.
We're taking a quick break to remind designers about Regina Andrew. Founded on the belief that everything they do should electrify the room, Regina Andrew sparks self-expression and creativity through unforgettable luxury home decor and design. Join their trade program and receive exclusive benefits like no minimum order requirement, white glove shipping options, and early access to sales. Plus, podcast listeners can save 10% off your next purchase by using the code BOH10 at checkout, now through November 15th. Learn more and start shopping at reginaandrew.com.
You had such a powerful kind of understanding of process from your architecture career. How did that inform what you started to put in place as your design business grew?
I mean, I think all of it, right? Because that is the way that my mind is geared. And also, like, I think that background very much informs the way I think. I also feel that for a highly creative person, I also have that other side of me that is very, every folder needs to be called out the same from project to project, every file. And so I kind of geek out when it comes to that type of like nitty gritty, detail oriented organizational structure. And that's helped a lot because I think you can gain so much efficiency. I always say the design process is messy and kind of nonlinear. So if all your other processes around that can be very rigid, then I think you're sort of set up for success. Because the more that your process can be very organized, then you can let the design be chaotic and experiment, you know, all of that.
How often are you working with another architect and how often are you doing the whole thing, architecture and design?
I'm trying to think right now of like the projects I'm working on right now. There's a architect builder for one of them for a project in Connecticut. I've got a new Palisades rebuild for that one. I'm doing all the architecture, interior or exterior. But I brought on an architect of record to work with me. So, eventually they'll start to take my files and turn them into the permit set and all of that. I've got a project in Costa Mesa that was started by an architect. So my interior architecture will then layer into theirs. So actually a lot. It happens a lot more than I was thinking.
Is the mix good or is there a perfect type of project for you?
I think a mix is good. You tend to flex different muscles with different projects. I'm just starting a new commercial showroom for a brand. I don't want to say yet, but it's a brand that we all know and love. And so that's exciting because it's a totally different, it still feels residential, because there's still the emotional attachment to it, but it's nice to, you know, start to get back to more of a commercial space. And then I'm working on this project, which is a purely digital project for the first phase. And that's also interesting because you get to flex different muscles. It's actually taken me back a little bit to the days when I was designing metaverse digital spaces and kind of developing those environments.
What got you into that? Or what was that? Like, how did you embark on some of the metaverse work you were doing?
It was fairly easy. It was during the NFT craze, during COVID, when people couldn't be out. And a woman asked me to commission me to design her metaverse house. And when she approached me, I was like, I have no idea what that means. But I, you know, like with everything, I became a student of it. I dug right in and I was like, oh, wait, this is kind of amazing.
Can I ask, how much do you charge for something like that? What is it? Cost to get a house designed in the metaverse.
Yeah, that was a different billing structure
totally
altogether. But it was it's a more intensive process. Also because we were I'm gonna geek out into this. What I wanted to build didn't exist back then. So basically a fully immersive space that was rendered super highly. So like super high fidelity, there wasn't a place for that. And so a lot of the worlds that became popular were super pixelated. So I approached it in a agnostic way when people would ask me, well, what world are you designing that house for? And it was like, I'm not designing it for a world. I'm designing the best case scenario. And then we took it and applied it to all the different metaverses that existed at that time. But it was fascinating. And I think for me, that's still, I think one day will come around. I always told the story of like walking into my son's room during COVID and he was playing Minecraft with all his friends who were all in different places. They had, you know, they were in Minecraft, they were on Messenger texting, they were on FaceTime, so they could see their faces and speak. And I remember thinking like, oh my gosh, that combination of all three of those, that's the metaverse. It allows people to not be in the same space and still digitally and virtually cohabitate.
What was different about working with a client to design a home for the metaverse versus, say, working with one of the residential clients you're working with now?
Very different, right? Because it's kind of like a fun project, right? You don't have to be able to sleep in it. And for me, it was always, and this was a huge lesson from one of my architecture professors in college, and it was always like, question the why. And for me, it was like, okay, great, metaverse space, but why? And how is it different? That for me was the fun part of it, was that you could build without materiality. You could build without physics. So how could that be a different expression of creativity that doesn't have to mimic the real world, but without becoming kooky and outlandish and weird?
Right. Like it's not floating in a cloud or something.
Right. And so, and I think that was like why you also want there to be a semblance of reality, also because it's what people are familiar with.
Right.
And why we're not all walking around in video games, which are completely kooky and, but even in terms of like scripting, right? I remember, and this, it always made for a fun story when I was doing like speaking on panels around the world on metaverse. But, I remember calling her one day and I was like, you know, this house doesn't really need a bedroom or doesn't really need a kitchen. You're not cooking, you're not sleeping in the metaverse. So the programmatic functions are totally different. And she was like, oh my gosh, you're right. And 30 minutes later, she called me back and she's like, okay, fine. No bedroom, but we're going to need a sex room. And I remember when she said that, I was like, oh my gosh, this metaverse thing is going to be huge.
Yeah, that's wild.
This is going to be huge. Just because if you think of like what the porn industry has done for any innovative technology, has, you know, usually made it thrive. And so I was like, oh, wow. Okay. And so that one project that has this like floating quote unquote sex room in the ocean. So it's And those were like the kind of cool things that you could do in the metaverse, right? Rooms could float in the ocean, but still make it tasteful and more to like what you would expect to see in a design publication.
Back to the real world for one second. You mentioned that your business has experienced pretty profound growth in the last few years. How have you had to evolve the way you approach the work?
I think you have to get more systematic. I think through our conversation, you probably realize I'm a geek for systems and organization. And I think it also, which a client who I've just finished two projects for, who is a CEO and a friend, and he always advises me on, like, I could get carried away in the nitty gritty details. And it's amazing for like him as a client slash friend to be like, sometimes you just have to like move on, like decide and move on. The client is going to be happy with that. It doesn't always have to be designed to death. And I think that's been super helpful for me to hear, right? That sometimes I strive for that perfection, but the business model of that doesn't really work. And so it's, how do you keep that in balance? And I think I have to become more cognizant of that when you have more projects and you can't spend 5 days designing a perfect door handle. Mm-hmm. I mean, it'd be amazing and I'd love to, but it just doesn't make business sense. And so that's I think been one big thing. And then staffing is the other one. It's really, really hard to find good people to work with and who get you. And, you could say blue and they kind of know exactly the type of shade of blue that fits that project. And so that's a work in progress, how I like staff up and start to bring on employees.
Have you made any hires yet, or are you still working mostly with contractors?
Mostly with contractors. Yeah, mostly with freelancers right now. I would love to find that perfect right person, but that's taking a little more time than I thought.
How many projects are you typically working on at one time?
Right now, I have 5 projects, and actually 5 of them are brand new. So it's going to be an interesting thing that all of them are at the same stage at the same time. I'm sort of hoping that there's like an efficiency of means as a result of
mindset,
that.
Maybe.
Yeah, exactly. Like you're going to the plumbing store at the same time for all 5. You know what I mean? Like, so I'm hoping that that is a byproduct of that. And then I have 1, 2, 3 projects that are done, but still need punch listings, still have some construction things going on. And then I've just photographed 2 projects, which, by the way, is also part of like the workflow, right? The administration of the ones that are now finished and you have photography and are about to get published or you're photographing and styling. And that's, I kind of considered those projects as well.
I want to pause for a moment and just acknowledge that you are doing all of this at a very high level alone.
Mostly, yeah.
That's pretty miraculous. Is hiring top of mind for you, or is it something you've been pushing off?
I've been pushing it off. Finally decided that it's something I need to do. And I think it's kind of finding that one right person.
But growth to you does not mean like running a team of 40. Or does it?
Yeah, that seems that it goes back to that question and that mindset of liability. What is the cost of that liability when you have a team of 40 and they can make mistakes just like you do, but now you're times 40. And then the whole management process of that, your job becomes completely different. And I think I still sort of enjoy the design process. I still enjoy all of that. So until I kind of get bored of it, then I kind of like the setup. that I have right now. I could see a team of 10. The other thing too is I'm able to offer a much more concierge experience to my clients when it's not a team of 40. I'm mindful of that's what the clients are getting, and that's sometimes why they're coming to me. I think some clients come to you and they've been to other firms and they realize that they're not dealing with the principal, they're dealing with an intern or whoever it is, and it's a very different experience.
Do you feel pressure to build a firm like the firms you see your peers building?
A little bit. I hear the anecdotes and the stories and it's like, wow, that sounds really painful. Like there is no price for that pain. And I've used the word several times. I think it's all about a good balance. And obviously it takes longer to get there, which is probably like the story of my life. Like everything just takes longer, but then it's better where you've arrived somehow.
How do you think about your firm's evolution and your firm's future as you look ahead?
Obviously continue to do amazing projects. I'd love to start to do more of the projects where really you get to showcase the full ability of what you can do, and they're not governed by a million parameters, whether it's budget, size, client's taste, etc. The other thing, and I've started this process somehow, but I did the rug collaboration with Modern Rugs LA. So I'd love to see more of that designing and developing product. I know I'd love to, the sort of conversations that are happening, I'd love to do a lighting collection next. And I think wallpaper could be super fun. So I'd love to see more of that. And then like this idea of special projects, which are not your traditional, whether it's a residence or a commercial space, but like I'm working on an installation during Art Basel in Miami. And so those I love. I think those really sharpen your skills in completely different ways and are fun, even though they're super challenging for a lot of reasons. But and so if I can keep that mix going, I think I would be super happy.
What does success mean for you today?
That's such a good question. And I think it goes back to that idea of what the ideal firm size looks like, right? Like it's kind of, I mean, it sounds so cheesy, but it's the what came to mind, like happy life, happy mind, or the other way around, happy mind, happy life. And I think it's that. It's kind of the less worrying and the more you're able to create and build beautiful things. I think that success, and obviously, if you're getting compensated for it, it's kind of like even better. But I do tend to think, and you know, this has also been a fault in my career in the sense that I don't always think profit first. And somehow it leads to something better and to profit eventually. But you just have to stick it out and it takes longer. And I think for me that like it all of that summarizes probably what that looks like.
That's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening. If you'd like to keep up with the latest design industry news, check out new products, or browse job openings, head on over to businessofhome.com. And if you're enjoying Trade Tales, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help others discover the show. If you have a note for the show or a story of your own to share, I'd love to hear from you. And you can email me at tradetales@businessofhome.com. Trade Tales is produced by me, Caitlin Peterson, and Caroline Burke. This episode was edited by Caroline Burke and Michael Castaneda. Our theme music is by Kyle Scott Wilson. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you back here next week.